Good morning, church. This is our last Sabbath of the Bio series. Can we give a round of applause to everyone who has shared for these past weeks? Church can't be unless we hear the stories of the people around us. And so it's so special that we get to do this. And today we have the pleasure of hearing from my brother James Kim. So glad that he said yes to our request for him to share. A little shout out to the Kims. They were one of the first families who, when Calmy and I moved here to Southern California, who hosted us in their home, gave us great food and great coffee. And thank you so much for that. And so glad that we've been able to grow in our relationship. And we've always felt your love from this family. So thank you so much. And I hope that you feel peace as you share it with your church family.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate that. Wonderful introduction. Before I start, I would be remiss if I didn't take a moment to thank my brother, Pastor Ben, here for helping me in preparation to tell the story. And for tolerating my tendencies as a procrastinator. I know he's a prepper, so if I created angst for you, Ben, you know, I think I apologized before, but I want to do that publicly. So I'll try to be a solid setup man for my closer here, okay? Seventeen years ago on a Sabbath morning, our family walked into the kindergarten classroom downstairs as first-time visitors. We were curious about the children's ministry program for our school-aged children, which we heard raves about. And a young woman named Shelley Lenore greeted us with enthusiasm and engaged us in a friendly conversation. 45 minutes later, as we were walking out of that classroom, my wife Lisa and I would find ourselves asking, what just happened? Because as somehow we had been effortlessly recruited to join the kindergarten Sabbath school teaching rota. And I'm still convinced that Shelley, you know, she may be a Jedi. You know, she's like, this is the church you're looking for, you know? So since that time, you know, this generous spirit has shaped our family's experience and deepened our connection with this La Sierra community over the years. And we're profoundly grateful for the friendships that have been fortified and the loving support that we've received. This community has not only enabled our family to grow and thrive over the past 17 years, but it's been extremely formative and is strengthening our conviction in a loving God whose grace surpasses all understanding and who challenges us to share this truth by displaying his beauty to all those around us. So to share about myself a bit, I'm a proud father of four extraordinary young people, Ian, Joel, Riley and Asher, three Gen Zers and an Alpha, who have taught me more than I ever imagined that I could teach them. So I couldn't be proud of you guys. Love you, no cap. You know, it's some Gen Z vernacular, you know. So my daughters, who probably made me promise I wouldn't embarrass them, watching and streaming from Southern Adventist, Riley and Joelle, that's for you. And I'm also the incredibly fortunate husband of the amazing Lisa Kim, who serves on the teaching faculty at Loma Linda Adventist Academy and previously served here with many of our friends here at La Sierra Academy. Professionally, I'm an emergency medicine physician. I work as both a clinician and an administrator in my mission field, what most people refer to as the ER, at Pomona Valley Hospital Medical Center in Los Angeles County. After my sophomore year in high school, I made the decision to transfer schools. My former school was an Adventist boarding academy with a work education curriculum that included both academic work responsibilities. I worked as a tractor parts packaging line. I worked custodial duties. And you know, living with a bunch of stinky guys, you know, created an environment that fostered really strong relationships and which I loved, and I excelled academically there, often being recognized as a top performer. But seeking a more rigorous academic experience, my younger brother and I enrolled at an out-of-state school known for more rigorous academic standards. The school was close to the university that my older brother attended at the time, and this allowed all three of us to live together and attend school together. So we moved into a small home in close proximity to the campuses and our extended family that lived in the area. My junior year, however, didn't go as I had hoped, and as a genuine introvert, although I fake it, I struggled to fit into the new school community, and I made very few true friends. You know, the increased academic demands also revealed that I was significantly behind my peers in almost every subject, and that rather than being a top performer, I was delivering questionably average work at best, despite my own perceived efforts. And I can, you know, for the first time recall living in a state of perpetual anxiety that was rooted in a fear of inadequacy and rejection by others. And rather than confronting my fears, I adopted a posture of self-rejection, and I convinced myself to stop caring. And resigning myself to failure was easier to accept than the possibility that I wasn't good enough. My feelings of inadequacy, you know, led to some destructive behaviors. I began to alienate myself from my community. I skipped a ton of school. I missed over 100 days of school that junior year. And I created a false narrative of, you know, various illnesses to justify my absence from school, forging parental notes, medical releases, all of this to conceal the deception that I was living at the time. And I recruited others into my deception, including my younger brother, who would be my liaison and delivery man for these forgeries, and my classmates as well, who I solicited help from to complete assignments and cheat and pass on exams that I wasn't present for. And of course, eventually my deception was discovered. My parents were called to meet with the school administration to discuss a disciplinary response. And years later, my mother revealed to me that during that meeting, my personal integrity was justifiably challenged, and I was on the verge of expulsion due to the overwhelming evidence of my numerous academic violations. My father reportedly became incensed, like bordering on rage, and he defended my character vehemently, arguing that it was being misrepresented. His fervent advocacy for me enabled him to negotiate for my placement on academic probation rather than being expelled, contingent upon compliance ongoing with, you know, citizenship and academic standards. Despite having every reason to be furious, I'm eternally grateful that my parents elected to respond with unconditional love and grace when I was most vulnerable. And after allowing me a few days to reflect on the series of choices that had determined my predicament, my father sat me down privately, and he proceeded to recount his own shared experience of overcoming his own insecurities when he was an adolescent. He reassured me of his unwavering love for me, regardless of the circumstances, and his continued faith in my potential, and that despite perceptions circulating about me, that he knew my true self. "James, I know who you are," my father said. And I told my wife, "I'm not going to cry, so give me a second." He said, "I know who you are." So I've never told my dad this, but I want him to know that his profound affirmation that day, it provided a glimpse of the restorative power of being beloved. And it marked the beginning of my transformation as I decided to confront my fear, motivated by the assurance that regardless of outcome, that I was loved and that I was enough. So three things from my adolescent life have remained with me to this day. The affirming relationships with my brothers and my cousins, who all played a large part in sustaining me during that difficult time, and who I still regard as my best friends. My golf swing, which was honed and forged during those long hours of recovery from feigned illness. And I just love golf. I had to throw that in there. I'm sorry. And of course, the residual emotional scar tissue from the profound loneliness and self-rejection that I experienced during that period of my adolescent life. In Life of the Beloved, renowned theologian and author Henri Nouwen writes that self-rejection is the greatest enemy of the spiritual life because it contradicts the sacred voice that calls us the beloved. Being the beloved constitutes the core truth of our existence. I repeat that. Being the beloved constitutes the core truth of our existence. You know, the fear of not being enough never truly goes away completely. Periodically, it creeps back when faced with certain challenges and circumstances as I navigate my life. But when insecurity and fear threaten to take root again, I find encouragement in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, in which he writes, "Let us be strengthened by his spirit, not by brute strength, but by a glorious inner strength. Let Christ live in us as we open the door and invite him in. And with both feet planted firmly on love, let us take in the extravagant dimensions of Christ's love. Reach out and experience the breadth. Test its length. Plumb the depths. Rise to the heights. Live full lives, full in the fullness of God." In my spiritual journey, I feel fortunate to have arrived at the conviction that I am cherished and beloved in God's eyes. And although this insight became clear to me in my adulthood, I realize that this assurance has been information throughout my life. My father's declaration that day was just one of the many times God's voice of love and affirmation has manifested through the people and experiences around me, providing me with a greater appreciation of the personal and unique nature of God's love for me. He knows who I am. So, Lost Sierra family, let us choose to live fully and fearlessly, rooted in the assurance that we are uniquely known, cherished, and extravagantly loved by God.
Thank you, James. Please stand with me as we hear the word. Text comes from Acts chapter 3, verses 1 to 8, and it says, "One day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Peter and John were on their way into the temple for prayer meeting. At the same time, there was a man crippled from birth being carried up. Every day he was set down at the temple gate, the one named Beautiful, to beg from those going into the temple. When he saw Peter and John about to go enter the temple, he asked for a handout. Peter, with John at his side, looked him straight in the eye and said, 'Look here.' He looked up, expecting to get something from them. Peter said, 'I don't have a nickel to my name, but what I do have, I give you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, walk.' He grabbed him by the right hand and pulled him up. In an instant, his feet and ankles became firm. He jumped up to his feet and walked." The word of God. You may be seated. James, once again, thank you so much for sharing your heart and your story. Thank God for adults who see the younger ones as their whole self. Thank God for adults who see young ones as more than just one moment. I was going back and forth about sharing this, but I'll just share it quickly. I had a story that something like that happened with me. And I've told this to the youth before, and I was like, I don't know if I should tell the church. I don't want to be judged too much. But when I was a kid, I just wanted things when I wanted them. But when you're a kid, you don't have income. You don't have money. And so if you want something, how can you get it? You can't just start working at the age of, 8 years old. I just, really wanted stuff. And so we had this convenience store in the basement of our apartment building, and it just had a bunch of snacks and stuff. And when my mom would leave, I was like, well, I need money. I'm sure she wouldn't mind if I just took a coin or some change from her purse. I went in there and I would grab the loonies and toonies. I don't know if anyone knows what that is. That's $1 and $2 in Canada. And I would grab loonies and toonies and just buy a little snack. And then I would do it again. And then I would do it again. And then as I got older, I realized there was more things that I wanted, and I wasn't working a lot. And so if I wanted to get something, I was like, my mom wouldn't mind if I just took this little amount to do something. And it was like getting toxic because like I wanted to fit in so badly around my friends so that I would take money so I could buy like clothes so that I could like look to fit the part. And my desire to like want to fit in led me to doing things that were harmful. And I'll never forget because one day my mom caught me. I was sitting in the living room, it was a normal day, and I just heard her scream in a different scream than I'd known before. So I was like, okay, the jig is up. And I remember I went upstairs and she was screaming at me. James, I didn't get the same conclusion. She punished me in a way that I don't want to talk about. She was responding to it and she was furious about what I did. And I remember the next morning I was like, I'm so ashamed because I've been caught doing such a horrible thing. So I started packing my bag. I put like my t-shirts. I was like, you know, I can't live here anymore. I don't know what I'm gonna do. My mom is so embarrassed with me. And my mom caught me. I think she was going to work in the morning or something. She saw me, she's like, Ben, what are you doing? I'm like, you know, I've been so shameful. I've done something so harmful against you. She's like, Ben, you're my son. You're my son. You're not going anywhere. Now go and like do the dishes. Like stop trying to run out of the house. Go do your chores. And like, we're moving on from this. You're still my son. Thank goodness for adults who see us so much more than the one choice that we make. How we choose to see people matters. How we look at things matter. Our perspective is important. And a part of what Jesus did as he walked on this earth was set a standard of what our perspective can be built on. But we struggle to look at things the way Jesus does because we prioritize our location, our prejudices, our harmful ideas more than what Jesus is trying to lead us into. The way we look at things matter. I got a concussion one time. I've got a concussion a bunch of times, but one time I remember very clearly. And I was playing rugby, as I love playing, and it was a home game. And something about home games is a little different because you know the people are there for you. Right? They're coming to watch, it's your classmates, it's your people, and they're watching me play rugby, and we were having a good time, and it was going in our team's favor, and I got the ball, and I was running, and like I really like felt like confident in where I was going. I'm like, I think I'm gonna score on this little run here. And I remember like my friends were in the crowd, my mom, my older brother were there, and as I was running, I could hear people cheering, and I started looking to the sideline as I was running with the ball. I'm looking at the sideline, because I'm kind of feeling myself, I'm pretty excited. And next thing I knew, I couldn't move anymore. Because someone had come and like began to tackle me. But it was a person who was like half my height because when I looked forward, I couldn't see them, but they were like well wrapped around me. And I'm kind of shocked because all my momentum, my excitement had just stopped. And next thing I knew, I was being lifted in the air and then things went black. It dropped me on my head. I just instantly knockout. And I remember coming to being dragged off by my mother on the sideline. She was pulling me and she was like pointing at the kid making threats. Right? And my brother is like, hey, mom, like that's how the game goes. You don't have to threaten the other team. Like, it's okay. That's how it happens. And when I came back to the sideline, my coach pulled me aside and said, Ben, where were you looking? Where were you looking? And that question really stuck with me to pay attention to what I'm doing. But I think today, more than ever, in the way that we respond as Christians, as people who know God, the way we respond to our neighbors, the way that we respond to news reports of suffering, oppression, crisis, discrimination, and pain, God is asking us, where are you looking? Where have we been looking? And there's something that we can learn from the story of Peter and John and the man who was set down at the temple gate. See, this man set on the steps of the temple was passed by daily by people who were going to worship. This person was set on the steps of the temple and they were passed by religious people. And these people who attended the temple to practice their religion missed out on the opportunity to live out their faith. And people passed him daily, ignoring him as he begged, until one day Peter and John passed by. And although this story is a beautiful example that teaches us how to give when we don't feel like we have much, for the next few minutes, I want to highlight the first action Peter and John did before speaking. They looked at the man with intention. And it was because they chose to look directly at the man, they saw who the man was, a child of God, a human being, a beloved creation. And because they saw him as he was, the man went from being outcasted on the steps to standing firmly in community. And yet, when I go online, I check Facebook and I see Instagram on my phone, on Twitter or whatever, I see community being destroyed because of the way we see each other. I see division and separation because of the way that we look at one another. We are not looking at one another in the same way Peter and John looked at that man on the steps. In the Message Bible, the text says, they looked him straight in the eye. In the New Revised Standard Version, it says, they looked intently at him. The Greek word in the manuscript is atenisas, root word atenizo, and it means being completely fixated on something to give the full attention to. And by looking in the way that they did, Peter and John, by giving their full attention and omitting their prejudices, they were able to look at the world with the eyes that Jesus intended, instead of looking at the world with the eyes formed by their worldviews. By beholding, we can be changed. And it's easy for us to come with our own conclusions when we just pass by one another. When we don't completely fixate on another person, it's easy for us to come to our own conclusions that could be harmful. And I know this because I struggle with this myself. When I'm entering the stores, and we know the stores, and we know our friends who are outside of the stores like Target and Walmart, it's easier if we just pass by quickly and we time it right so that there's someone else in front of us to be talked to. Or we try and walk faster or act like we're having a phone call, because if we were to give our full attention, how could we deny their humanity? But it's difficult to do so. And when we choose to look intently, we see the miracle. We see the image of God. We see a loved humanity. But when we choose to pass by people, we see them through dim lenses and our worldviews. Our lenses that can be murky with hate. Our lenses that can be murky with pride. Our lenses that blur the fact that who we're looking at is already loved. Suffering deserves our full attention. And there are people who do not know how God sees them because they've been told that they are worthless, that they are sinners, that they are disappointments. And these people deserve our full attention. They deserve to be reminded that they are already beloved by God, no matter what they have done or what they are going to do. But to do this, we must choose to look intently. These past few weeks, the world has had their eyes on the 2024 Summer Olympics. From track events to basketball, swimming, rugby, the list goes on. And there's been so much to celebrate for these national ambassadors. They've been doing amazing things. And it's so funny when you watch Olympics, because like, I was just talking to the youth this morning, and we view things, we really feel like we can judge things, right? When we're watching it, you know, and like Steph Curry missed a shot, you're like, oh, Steph, you gotta make that. And I was like, wait, why am I saying that? I'm like a person that can never even shoot a ball in my life. And so how am I commenting on one of the best shooters in the world? Like, but when we're watching things, it's so easy for us to comment on things. And even though we've been watching these athletes do amazing things, somewhere along the line, we've forgotten that they're human. And we've forgotten that they are made by a creator who loves them, each and every one of them. And we've tried to diminish some of these athletes to a spectacle to receive hate because we've been watching unintentionally. And I'm not talking about sharing frustrations because of the medal they did or did not win, but the outright discrimination of these athletes because the way they look does not sit right with the way some loud voices see the world. I'm talking about Iman Khalif because she's a strong woman. I'm talking about Katie Ledecky because she's a strong woman. Lin Yuting because she is a strong woman. And this is the kind of the terrible reality and the toxic reality of people being scared of strong women. And it's coming out in the way people respond. And this is how we've responded to people we don't even know. We have no idea who these people are, yet we are so critical and judgmental and displacing that they're beloved humanity. What about the people in our own communities, at our schools, in our homes? How have we reminded these people of their value? Have we paused and given our full attention to the people around us? We are called to look at the people around us, affirm them, affirm that they are known, affirm them that they are beloved, even at their lowest moments. See, James's father, Dr. Kim, understood this. He looked at James and said, I know who you are. And for anyone who's here today that needs to hear it, I want to say that you are not a bad person because you made a choice that you didn't like. You at your lowest point, or when you make a mistake, is not defined by that thing. You are not defined by that choice. It doesn't take away that you're loved. You are known. And there's also people who have made choices that are not mistakes, that deserve to be known and deserve to know that God loves them. The things that we don't understand, and the things that make us uncomfortable because they're different, are not automatically mistakes. Even when we don't know the person, we can still look at them with intention. When Jesus' robe was touched by the woman with the issue of blood, he gave her his full attention. When Jesus heard the blind person crying out, he gave them his full attention. When Jesus encountered people who others mocked and discredited, he gave them his full attention. And he did so because God had already defined them as good and as beloved. Before we say anything harmful, we need to know that God's already trying to remind that person of their value. No matter how our context has formed us to see that other person, they are still a miracle. They're still beloved. The action someone makes does not take away God's love from them. Someone's ability does not take away God's love for them. The way we view others does not take away God's love for them. We are all already loved no matter what. The teenager who's been outcasted by adults around them is already loved. The person who you need to cut out of your life because your views have become too opposing, believe it or not, that person is already loved. The auntie who shares strange articles on WhatsApp, that person's loved. That old friend of yours who makes posts on Facebook that grinds your gears and you're like, why are they even in my life? What happened? Our history together? That person is already loved. God already loves them, and we are invited to participate in what the Holy One is doing by pausing and looking at people with intention. As loved, created beings, just as how we also are, before we do or say anything. James, I love this verse that you shared because when we look at people intently, this is how we take in the extravagant dimensions of Christ's love. This is how we rise up to the heights. It's how we live full lives, full in the fullness of God, by affirming others, making sure people know that they're known, making sure people know that they're beloved, when we affirm others in that same love that Christ has for each and every one of us. Amen.